Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. You are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. Very exciting stuff to talk about today, going over the Survivor Philippines premiere. Excuse me. My name is Colin, and I'm here with Dom. Dom, what's going on?
Quite a lot at the moment, as it happens. We just saw Big Brother 14 wrap up last night. Survivor 25 begins, so we're going to be talking about both of those. Only Survivor 25 today, but I'm looking forward to talking about both of those over the next week. And I should add that today we are joined, as we often are, by our good friend, formerly ESPN's, but still kind of ESPN's, but mainly now Pinnacle Sports, is Gary Weiss. Gary, how are you doing?
So you told me I would get to talk about Dan Geisling getting Russell Hantz out of the big prize on Big Brother.
I was going to ask you about that, but only as a kind of throwaway thing. But if you want to talk about it, then yeah, sure, get into it.
Well, I think that what Dan has shown us is that no matter where your heart lies, despicable behavior on these shows is utter suicide. As much as I think what Dan did was absolutely brilliant, I think that these games are too social for people to forget the social elements when making a decision as to whether or not to give you $500,000 or $1 million.
I agree completely with what you just said. I think, yeah, Dan is, certainly in my opinion, and I think in many people's opinion, solidly the second best player of all time now, but I think you're absolutely right about when you do things like what Dan did, and I promise we'll talk about Survivor, when you do things like that, it's just the jury's not going to forgive swearing up and down on the Bible and your grandfather's cross and your wife's, your wedding ring and everything. It's not like Will Kirby never did that, for instance, and people who are successful on these shows don't do that kind of thing.
But Will Kirby never had to do that.
That's correct.
I actually don't believe that Dan Geisling could have possibly won this game.
You don't?
No, I don't. I think that targets were put on their back by the fact that they were all-stars coming in, by their not having to go through the starting stages. You know, they started a little bit behind. They kind of had their alliances pre-chosen for them. I don't think that, you know, I think that Dan would have eventually gotten taken out if he hadn't gone to such lengths to preserve himself.
I don't know. I think it is weird because we can look at his game and say that, oh, he fell prey to the same kind of thing that Boston Robin Orsaz did or Russell Hans did or whoever you want to bring in. But I just think he got very unlucky at a series of points and all of those kind of like build it up into this perfect storm that led to him losing. I think he could have won, but just not as things played out past like the halfway mark.
I think the reason he survived is because he made agreements that had to be backstabbing agreements in order for him to survive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Definitely. Now, would you say that this is a jury robbery on the same level you would say about Russell Hans or Boston Rob?
I would say that it's actually a bigger robbery than Russell Hans's, because I don't think Russell's was a robbery, because Russell was a despicable human being playing a social game.
Yeah, I think Russell, for the same reasons that like Dan could never win this season, Russell's going to have a really, really hard time, perhaps an infinitely hard time, a.k.a. could never win a season of Survivor, if he takes such aggressive tactics where it's like, yes, this will help you get further and get to the end a big percentage of the time, but you can never then win because of how you got there. Yeah, sure. Well, you know what, guys? How about we talk some Survivor today? Before we get into Survivor, actually, Gary, a lot has been happening with you since the last time that we talked. You know, you had your first kid, very notably, so I feel congratulations are definitely in order on that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and now also, as Dom mentioned, as Dom mentioned off air, you're now in Curacao for a little while. So what's happening there?
I am. I'm in Curacao until December 1st. I am undergoing training for a new job at Pinnacle Sports, which is a very exciting development in my life. As a result, I'm not writing about poker as much, and I will continue to not write about poker as much. It may eventually evolve into my not writing about poker, period, but for the moment, I am still with ESPN, and I'm grateful to be able to maintain that relationship.
Excellent. So what can you tell us about what you're doing with Pinnacle?
I'm not ready to go public with a position yet, because going public might affect some of the work that we're doing. It will come out soon enough, and I'll be sure to come back and share it with you.
Okay, absolutely.
And it's a fantastic opportunity for me, and I'm really excited to be doing it.
Very cool. So if you guys are ready to get into some Survivor, you know, last night was the premiere. Very exciting stuff. Thrilling episode, so let's get right into it.
Before we get into it, I have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
I have a question for you, Colin.
Okay. Because
over the last many months, you and I have had some in-depth conversations about the approach that one takes to an interview. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when certain people come on, like Kim, for example, one thing that I have told you is you have to determine beforehand what is their incentive for coming on and doing the interview. And so what my question for you now is what is my incentive for having come on and done this interview?
Well, that's interesting you ask. When we were talking earlier, I remember one of the times we had you come on, you were talking about a project that you couldn't really get into yet. And then we were talking earlier and the Pinnacle Sports news came up, that really got me thinking about that. And so that your actual question about people having incentive for coming on, apart from just maintaining this, oh, Gary Wise is going to come talk to us about the premiere streak, is I imagine that's that there's a lot of there are a lot of people listening that are that would also potentially be very big fans of yours.
Well, okay, so a couple of responses. First of all, the project I referenced last time was a website that eventually fizzled. It was not Pinnacle. Pinnacle was not a gleam in my eye at the time when I spoke about it. Second of all, your answer was very long and inventive and creative and involved, and my answer is actually very simple. I would love Tom and Colin podcast.
Well, thank you. We love Gary Wise.
Nice. Mutual Admiration Society commenced.
Yeah, thank you very much, Gary. We're thrilled to have you on, as always. So what do you say we get into some Survivor now, finally? And I think sure. The place we want to start here is, of course, with talking about the returning players, because we're very interested about your thoughts. You know, we talked to Gordon Holmes about this last week, but we definitely want to hear from you, your thoughts about the returnees prior to actually the start of this season. So if you want to start, I guess, with, like, Russell Swan.
All right. I think, just like a lot of people, I was less enthused about the return of Russell Swan than I was about the other two. Russell was a character on his season, but he wasn't a pivotal character. He was the quote-unquote leader, but we don't really see any real examples of leadership. He just kind of got thrust in the role and just made some dumb decisions, and that was it. But that's the thing. My feelings about Russell coming in were that he was a one-level player, and I don't think you can be a one-level player and be really successful at Survivor. I felt like his being here, I think it was Christine on last season who made the comment about Coach going out early, in the initial scrum with Probst.
But yeah, she called them temporary players.
Right. Russell Swan is the perfect temporary player. Like, you just can't win this game. Like, by just being open and honest and not really thinking about things on multiple levels.
Okay, so you don't think Russell Swan can win them?
I didn't think so before yesterday. Now I think he's absolutely awful. He came to me as an absolute idiot last night. And I'm sure that that's in part the edit. I think it's real testimony, what we saw last night, to the fact that the edit makes such a huge difference in the way we perceive players. Because I'm sure that this Russell Swan was the exact same guy who played the first time around, and we didn't see him being this awkward, obnoxious jackass. We saw him being a little bit more of a quiet leader. Like last time we saw him as the unwilling leader. This time we see him as this moron who keeps talking about how he doesn't want to lead and then like shushing people when they try to speak to him.
I think him being taken out in smoke, while it must have been a scary experience for him physically, of course, I think it was a boost to his, or a boost of what he had as a Survivor reputation, because I think had he stayed in the game, he would have crashed and burned eventually in the same way that we see him doing now. And had that happened, he probably would have just been forgotten, never even being considered as a possible returnee, whereas now he's getting a second chance and botching it as he probably would have done in his first one.
Well, here's the thing. He made the comment when they landed on their beach about, look where it got me. And he made comments to the camera before they even got to the beach, saying, this time these people have to run with me or I'm going to run them over. I don't think Russell Swan understands what leadership is. I think he thinks that leadership, period, is actually leadership by example.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of interesting.
Leader, so he felt like he had to do all the work.
So because I think in his mind, at least as I think the general perception of like a leader in the sense that, oh, I don't want to be a leader because that's what gets you voted out, is in the Survivor sense, at least, telling people what to do, which is, I think, what he's trying to avoid. But then, of course, when we get to the challenge, we'll be talking about
what to
yeah.
do strategically. I think you need to tack the word strategically on the end there. So I think that he's telling people, how to carry out a task or how to carry out even a challenge is fine. When we're talking about, who are we going to vote for and so on, then it becomes a little bit more awkward, at least if it's a nuanced thing. Obviously, last night it wasn't so nuanced. We're going to talk about Zane a little bit, and I'm going to rant. Holy God, am I going to rant. But, Zane obviously made it really easy for Russell to say, okay, I guess we're going to go for Zane. And I think that when it came to his organizing votes otherwise, like if it wasn't so obvious, it might be a little bit more something that he personally felt like he wanted to avoid. Last night was an extreme situation.
Okay, well, we're definitely going to be getting into everything that went down last night. Before we do, what do we have to say about, what did you think about Mike Scoopin coming into this season?
I think that Mike Scoopin's fire moment is the seminal moment in Survivor history. So I'm going to do, I think every single time I come on here, I lament making poker analogies, and then I make poker analogies. I think that Scoopin is Greg Raymer or Joe Hashem to Richard Hatch's Chris Moneymaker. You know, Hatch got people's attention when it was still small, made it mushroom, and then Scoopin was the guy who celebrity kind of benefited from that mushroom effect.
I know exactly what you're saying, actually. Yeah, so it's like, on his if he had played in, like, season 13, he wouldn't have been nearly as big of a character, even if he had fallen into the fire. But because Survivor was really at its peak, and him being, like, the number one guy on Kucha, really, which was, like, the most popular tribe maybe in Survivor history, and then having something as drastic as falling into the fire happen when the viewership is higher than it's ever been, really, is really what cemented his legacy, just because so many eyeballs were on him rather than what actually him himself.
Yeah, you know, like, even if he had done it in season one, it would have been the event that would make people say, oh, by the way, you should be watching Survivor, and then people would have tuned in. But they still wouldn't have seen it. Everybody saw Michael Scoopin. If you're talking about water cooler moments of the last 25 years in television, this has to be like top five, top 10. You know, especially if you're limiting it just to non-sport, non-news television.
Yeah, and I know this it may be difficult for Dom because he was not in America or watching Survivor at the time. But yeah, this was back when Survivor was just like the biggest thing on TV.
Yeah, no, it was literally the biggest thing on TV. This was the moment that made everybody, as much as we all understood that it was for real, this was the moment that cemented that reality. And yeah, I would go so far as to say that if Michael Scoopin doesn't fall in the fire, Survivor might not be on today. I think it probably wouldn't be.
That's a big statement. That's very interesting. Do you think it had that big of an impact?
I think it had a big impact. It was literally what everybody in the world, like in the North American scope of the world, was talking about the next day and for weeks to come. And it impacted the show so heavily, and it made it so obvious that, you know, sure, there was this luck factor, but at the same time, these characters became all the more relatable because they were in real danger that we would experience ourselves when we were in their situation.
Well, I would say, I would perhaps counter by saying if Scoopin doesn't fall in the fire and then Kucha goes on to steamroll, then America's Tribe goes on to win. And then if you have Ethan winning the next time, I don't know if that, you know, maybe they cast different people if someone other than Colby goes deep, for instance. Sure. But it's obviously, of course, a big butterfly effect thing, but that's a very interesting idea that it might have had that big of an impact.
And the funny thing about it all is, I don't think Michael Scoopin would have done that well in season two if he hadn't fallen in the fire.
I think he would have got, I think he's a very overbearing guy, at least as he was portrayed there.
Right, he was overbearing, he was a little bit socially awkward, he was obviously a massive physical threat, he was the very obvious target for the other tribe to be aiming for the entire time, and then what if his tribe had survived that kind of a melee, then he still had sort of established himself as a bit of an outcast on his own tribe. Like, you know, he wasn't listening to what other people wanted to do. He spent a lot of time off in the canoe, fishing and hunting and so on. And, you know, I really don't know that Michael Scoopin would have done particularly well. And he certainly never showed us any particularly strong strategic chops.
I think there's a nostalgia and the people who, you know, down the line when they're asking the finalists, oh, who would you rather see sitting in these seats? And I think they both said Mike, even though he was on the other tribe or whatever.
Right.
Because he fell in the fire, he was remembered so fondly, I think. And that, I think his reputation would be much, much different if we had seen him continue on at the same path he was on.
And, you know, with all this said, with my not thinking that much of him as a Survivor player per se, I was so excited that he was on the season. I still am.
Definitely. What did you think about how he was going to do?
Well, I did a couple of drafts, and I thought he was either middle or upper middle to use Gordon's terminology from your show last week. Good job, by the way. I thought he had a chance. I think that, you know, obviously he had some wisdom coming in that he hadn't had previously. And at the same time, he had this kind of all-American thing going for him that was going to be helpful to him for surviving the early part, which, you know, for someone his age is often going to be an issue, although obviously he's not really a guy his age for his age. You know, he's in insane shape. I thought he would do pretty well, but I put him as a real long shot to win, though. I got to make one other point about Scoopin', and that's this. It's so seldom, especially in reality television, that we get closure on our storylines like this. Like, I don't know about you guys. I assume come All-Stars when we didn't see – sorry, not All-Stars, Fans vs. Favorites, when we still hadn't seen Michael Scoopin, we were never going to get resolution on this thing. And here we are, 25 seasons in, and happy anniversary, everybody. You know, and we finally get some answers about what kind of a player is Michael Scoopin, and I think that's really awesome. That, for me, is the most exciting subplot of this season, at least going in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can totally dig what you're saying. And, yeah, someone should go out and buy Jeff Probst a silver a snuffer for the 25th year, or season at least.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I think – yeah, before we move on to Penner, one thing I wanted to bring up is, Dom, you've apparently heard that Colton confirmed that he turned this season down, and this is why we ended up coming back to Penner for his third time. Instead of someone else, Colton would have been his second time to kind of fit with the rest of his team. Did you have any thoughts on that, Gary? Because Colton was someone I know you had some thoughts about last season. So what would you have, like, if Colton had come back and played this season, I guess, would you have been down, like, cool with that, watching him play again?
I would be cool. I found Colton to be immensely entertaining. But I watched from a very observational viewpoint. I think that's probably just a byproduct of the reporting I've done in the past. I think that a lot of people would have still had a lot of anger, and it would have been tough for them to forgive that, and I think they may have actually had some audience backlash over that because Colton was so overwhelmingly negative.
Do you think he might have changed at all his second time around?
Would these people have seen Colton's season?
That's a good question, because I was going to actually bring up that same point. I don't know, and I don't know if it would have had – I don't know if part of the impact they were really going for – is, you know, when Probst asks Roxanne, what's the worst you've seen, and hoping someone brings up Russell Swan. I'm sure they asked several of them until one of them brought up someone that was coming back. And I think, of course, if they hadn't seen Colton's season, they wouldn't know that. And I don't know what would have happened with regard to filming, but I think if they're going to bring back a couple other people as returnees instead of for an All-Star season, I know people didn't get to see Rupert play before All-Stars or Russell play before Heroes and Villains. I think they probably would have shown them One World, or at least Colton's portion of One World.
Well, the funny thing is, I think that if they had not seen his season, it would have been immensely entertaining. And if they had seen his season, he wouldn't have survived more than one or two days. Oh, sorry, one or two votes. It would have been a big nothing, to my mind. I think that they would have all found him so detestable, they would have just agreed, yeah, let's just get rid of him first.
To return to the point you made about closure there, Guy, I don't think there's any closure that we need to see from Colton's storyline. I think had he survived in One World, he would have been there causing carnage and being racist for a while, and then would have been blindsided probably, or would have lost overwhelmingly in a jury vote. And there's no kind of continuation to that storyline that we really need to see him, like, enact in another season. I think if you bring him back at the same time as you're bringing back these grandfathers of the game in Scoopin' and Panic, it kind of taints the idea of bringing any of them back in the first place.
Yeah, I think I agree. You know, I like your point about the lack of need for closure with Colton. I think that's very accurate.
Okay, well, another guy we may not necessarily have needed closure for, because this is now his third time playing, but I am certainly thrilled to see him come back, is Jonathan Penner. Now, Gary, what are your thoughts on Jonathan, you know, entering the season?
I think, first of all, he was excellent in dragging the Bruce Lee story. Where he played the smarmy television executive.
He's a little oriental, isn't it?
Too oriental.
Yeah.
Beyond that, like, I like Penner. I think Penner obviously makes for good confessionals, makes some questionable decisions that usually play well dramatically. He's too confrontational, for my taste, as a player, in terms of strategics, but, you know, he's good television. You know, he's always going to give you his honest opinion in those confessionals. He doesn't quite know enough to shut up in a situation where he needs to shut up. And, you know, he's a bit of a prick. And pricks are usually good for the greater scheme of things. You know, I don't know if you guys heard Cesternino's interview with Johnny Fairplay this week. And granted, Johnny Fairplay is not exactly the greatest character reference regardless. But even Johnny Fairplay is like, oh, I hate this guy. He's a prick. Such an asshole. And, like, you know, Penner is always going to inspire reactions. Like, he's never going to purple color you. And, you know, so I'm always happy to have a guy like that on a show I'm going to watch.
Oh, totally. I agree. Yeah, I think Penner is one of the best narrators we've had in a long time. He's totally always got, like, his heart on his sleeve in Survivor. He had a very interesting, and we can talk about this more in a little while, about that scene where he was very early at the, how did Probst pronounce it, Kalabau tribe, where he was just, like, so thrilled to be back and get that another chance to be playing. And I really like that kind of, like, youthful enthusiasm out of Penner.
Yeah, you know, he obviously appreciates the game. He appreciates the opportunity. Like, you know, Swan appreciated it too, but, you know, it was kind of a muted thing. You know, Penner being an actor is going to emote. I think that's very, very clear. But, you know, it allows for us to appreciate through that emoting just what this really means. You know, it's nice to have things spelled out for us without being spoken to like we're idiots.
Now, Gary, do you like the idea of returning players in general? And if so, what are you looking for from someone who's filling that role?
I think first of all, regardless of whether or not I like the idea, it's obviously necessary. You know, the producers have made it a very regular thing, which suggests to me that they are finding through their market research that it is an absolute must. Now, apparently, I think I just read before we started taping that last night's premiere was down 9% from the previous premiere, which is a bad sign.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously, I don't see how having these guys at a premiere, for example, is going to hurt the numbers. Once you get into the question of what am I looking for, I'm looking for personality. I wasn't a big fan of Ozzy coming back, but only because I don't feel like Ozzy has much of a personality. He's just, you know, he's just a bit of a conceited prick, you know, and who obviously thinks very highly of himself, and that's about it. At least Coach, while having those qualities, also has some other interesting aspects to him. Penner is the kind of guy who I'm happy to see him come back because, you know, he's not Boston Rob, who's obviously going to dominate the game. But he's not Ozzy, who I find to lack charm. You know, like I guess charm is a really good word for it. You know, somebody who I enjoy seeing on my television. You know, Penner is going to, at some point in this game, do something monumentally stupid. And I'm going to enjoy watching him go through that process. Because, you know, it makes me feel good about myself, but also, it's just, you know, he's an amusing guy to watch. You know, there's just some people in this world who inspire those kinds of feelings, and I think he's one of them.
I think the thing about Penner, which makes me kind of curious about him as a returning player, is I don't want him to do well, despite the fact that I love the guy and I'm really excited to see him back, because it seems to be a pattern with returning players where when they're in a position of power and they get to coach really easily, then it seems like all the fun of having them back just kind of gets sucked out of the experience. I think that's especially true with Penner, who is always at his best when his back's up against the wall and when he has to make these tough decisions that he ends up alienating people by making them. And
do
so,
you think it's plausible that he'll do well without taking a leadership role in his tribe?
I think that's an open question. I don't know. I like the tribe that he has if he is going to do well. Like, I think he's set up pretty nicely there. Whether or not his competition is actually one that's salvageable, I don't know. But what are your thoughts on that?
Someone, you know, suggested that last night was a winner's edit and, like, try to make it appear like he's back against the wall. And you know, I think last year I read too much into edits, and so I'm trying very hard not to do that this time. I think that his tribe is it's a misfit tribe. It's kind of an island of misfit toys kind of deal. Obviously, the producers are trying to make it look like he's back against the wall. I'm not as convinced. I think that he looked really good in the challenge yesterday, and that is never lost on anybody. And I think physically they're looking pretty tough right now too. I think that there's a chance that he could do a decent. Like if he can make the merge, I think he can stick around for a while because he's not a huge threat. You know, I think with the returning players, there's bound to be a mindset of, well, we're going to get him eventually. You know, like,
right, yeah, no. I think especially on his tribe. Oh, sorry.
So what I said was, it's not like we're going to forget he's here, so we'll get him later. And so it's a convenient excuse to let somebody coast along for a while, just long enough to create the kind of bonds that can keep you on the island to the end. So I think he has – I certainly don't put him at zero percent chance to win right now. And I don't see him being a massive leader either. He was never a leader in his other seasons. Like, he tried to be a leader and failed multiple times. He's just not a leader type. He's too nebbish.
It seems like your claim about the necessity of having returning players is almost self-fulfilling, because if you have all of these seasons where you keep bringing people back and the audience becomes used to the idea of having these familiar people as anchors for their viewing experience, then it becomes almost impossible to wean them off that and go back to a bare-bones season like One World, which happened to be very poorly received.
Right. I think One World was poorly perceived because it was poorly executed.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a fair criticism, and I would throw in a third plus one to that. So before we get into the actual, you know, what we saw in the premiere and everything, there was, I'm sure, Gary, as big of a baseball fan and expert as you are, another face that you recognized entering the season, that being, of course, Jeff Kent. Now, Dom and I are both grossly lacking in terms as it pertains to, like, in-depth Jeff Kent knowledge, and this is something I'm hoping you can help us out a bit, because we tried to touch on this a little bit with Gordon, but just none of us knew all that much about him. So if you could fill us in about what you know about Jeff Kent and, like, his reputation in baseball, and then how you think things might go for him on Survivor.
Well, Jeff Kent actually started out with my team, the Toronto Blue Jays, so he's a guy who, even beyond his being an all-star caliber player, and according to some debaters, a Hall of Fame caliber player, and he's a guy who I was always particularly aware of. And he made a gigantic contribution to one of our championship-winning teams by getting traded for a pitcher who pitched in the World Series for us. So, big fan of Jeff Kent in that regard. In terms of what I know about him, obviously a very competitive guy. He has some attitude, and not only does he have attitude, but he has attitude that I think that liberally minded people would probably regard as ignorance. He's made comments about, I believe about homosexuality that might be deemed colorful. There are some people who have suggested that he might be a little racist. I don't know if there's any proof of that out there. I do know that he was teammates with what may be the greatest baseball player of all time, a guy named Barry Bonds, a cantankerous asshole who just knew how to hit a baseball better than everybody else. And rather than try to be cohesive and be a team, at least from the outside perspective, Kent was always the guy who was most at odds with Bonds. They were always butting heads. He was always making public comments to the media about Bonds and what a son of a bitch he was. To Kent's credit, one year he won the Most Valuable Player award. Probably should have been Bonds, but Bonds is supposedly hated by the media too. That I guess they just kind of, you know, they may have even liked the fact that Kent was a guy who just didn't take Barry's shit. So that's his reputation coming in. He's definitely Southern, he's a red state kind of guy. I would see when I saw him. I kind of saw the alpha male guy, the guy who described himself as a rooster last year.
Matt Quinlan.
Thank you. I saw him as being pretty close to Matt as far as character types, which does not bode well.
Okay, so how did you think he had any kind of shot to win entering the season, or are you kind of ruling that out?
I did a three-way draft with two friends of mine. Just doing a reverse snake, and I passed him up. With my second to last pick, with five players left, I passed him.
Okay. I take that as not a pretty resounding thumbs down as far as optimism.
No, I actually think he came off better last night than I expected him to, and I still don't expect him to win.
I would actually say something very, very similar. Now, the last person that we're going to talk about before we get into the actual tribes themselves is the other kind of celebrity in the group, and that's Lisa Welchel. Now, the facts of life was a little bit before Archon. Yeah, but yeah, so, sure, whatever. Yeah, go ahead.
What Scoopin said was so dead on. Like, so I even posted to Facebook last night, I know I'm getting old because it's inconceivable to me that people would not recognize Lisa Welchel. Because, first of all, Blair Warner was on syndicated television like four times a day, every day, for like a decade. And second of all, she looks exactly the same. It's ridiculous. the woman has not aged in 20 years. So it's I understand being too young, and I have friends who responded to that post by saying I had no idea who she was. But, like, I gotta say, for her to go in thinking that she could hide her identity is absolutely ridiculous. It's not like everybody on the show was 30 and younger. Like, obviously the Scoopins of the world are gonna recognize her. You know, like, and the thing is, now I feel like, whereas I felt like she might have a shot coming in, I now don't. And the reason I don't is that she's not self-aware enough to understand the level of her celebrity, so how could she be self-aware enough to understand her place in the game?
That's interesting, because we saw both she and Jeff Kent both voice that they were going to try to hide their identities because they didn't want people having, you know, predispositions about, oh, this person's got money, they've already had their 15 minutes of fame, what have you, and vote them out on those grounds. So do you see that, not going well? Because we saw kind of Scoop and want her to out it, perhaps for the same reasons you did, which is, this is going to come out, you might as well tell it yourself.
Well, you know, I think, first of all, if Ken had shaved the mustache, he might have gone away with it, because people are used to seeing a baseball cap on his head, they don't actually know what his head looks like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that changes perspective a little bit. With her, the thing is, she has the perfect story. Like, in reality, you know, we invested in the 80s craze. It all crashed. I lost all my money. Yes, I am more recognizable than you people. That's just the only benefits I have to that is life experience. You know, if she came out and told them that, you know, they wouldn't have cared about the TV show. They would have appreciated the life experience. Instead, her secrets seem, at least in part, to be isolating her from the tribe. She's not mixing with them well. There obviously might be other stuff going on there. But, you know, like, I think it's pretty obvious that in the first few days of this game, you need to be making fast, strong bonds as quickly as is humanly possible. And she's there, while everybody else is doing that and getting their bond on, she's there trying to hide her true self from these people she needs to rely upon for the next however many weeks.
That's a very good point. And, yeah, especially with smaller tribes, you best be fitting in early.
Absolutely. Like, I give Kent this credit. He was absolutely accurate about the importance of the three tribe split. You know, you've got to – it puts the game on fast forward. You know, with two tribes, 9 players per tribe, you have some time. You can be likable, fade into the woodwork, wait for the two loudmouths at the beginning of the game to get at each other and split the tribe down the middle. One of them goes home. With this, especially for a small – like for an older woman, you know, she's obviously not an old woman, but she's older than the other women on her tribe. You know, it's so crucial that she make herself stand out as a strong ally. You know, because she has the target on her back as the weak physical player. You know, I just don't know what she's thinking.
Now's as good a time as any, I think, to get into the actual tribes themselves. And we can start with the Tandang tribe, which is, for those with short-term memory, is Scoopin, Artis, Lisa, Pete, RC, and Avi Maria. What are you thinking about this tribe coming in?
They look strong physically to me. They didn't have a Zane and they didn't have Penner. Mm-hmm. And RC looks to be the most powerful woman in the game, like physically. So, you know, I think they look pretty good for the early going. excuse me.
What we ended up seeing happen here is RC and Abby Maria end up bonding pretty quickly, and they both come across pretty aggressively and start, like, trying to form an alliance immediately, and things happen very quickly on this tribe, and they both kind of want, like, Pete and Scoopin to be 3 and 4 in their alliance. So what do you have to say about these girls, that RC and Abby Maria?
I think given the six player tribes, I think that aggression is very smart. I think that we've seen a lot of the times in the past when alliances are formed on days 1 or 2, like eventually the cracks show. I think they might be underestimating Pete, actually. I found that he's understated, but he didn't strike me as a dumb guy. He actually gave us our funniest moment of the episode for me when he made the comment to the cameras, kind of smirking, saying, you know, about Scoopin, saying, we'll see how he does when we get fire. You know, it's like he's half expecting the guy to fall in, so he's got like a cynical bent, which I personally like, and maybe that's coloring my impression of him. But yeah, they look very strong physically. Obviously, like you said, the two girls are really making things happen politically. which, you know, if we see a merging of the three tribes down to two, those kind of quick political bonds are going to be important. So yeah, I think they're looking pretty, like, I think they're the most solid of the three tribes right now. You know, like, I see the Kent tribe as a collection of misfit toys. And I think that there are going to eventually be some real problems there. I don't want to get ahead of it, but yeah, you know, I think that these guys are really solid. I think that they're the most likely tribe to be solid, like, right up until the merge.
Yeah, I agree that Pete would like us all to believe that he's smarter than we think he is, but whether or not that's actually true, I don't know. But yeah, I agree. I think when you have these six-person tribes, it comes very easy for a player like RC, who's forward-thinking, to just take control immediately, because usually with the way they cast the tribes, there's going to be one person who's on the outs immediately, and there's a consensus first boot. So once that person goes, you only need to find two other people, and you're in a majority, and you're safe for foreseeable future. Whereas right. if you're on a 9 or 10 person tribe, you have to put in a lot more work, and it's a lot harder to make all of that come together.
You know, to his credit, I think Scoopin gave her the perfect answer when she approached him. I think his answer of, hey, you got to start somewhere, is not only absolutely right, but I think it was a great piece of conversation. It was honest enough for her to trust it. And at the same time enough, you know, it bought him a lot of time to decide what he actually wants to do. But going back to what you said about Pete, by the way, I really found Pete to be very likable in his interviews. He stood out to me as a guy who wasn't, you know, outrageous in his behavior, but as somebody who was probably thinking tactically and could go pretty far in the game.
Sure,
go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, guys. I completely cut you off. I didn't hear you for a second. But let's get into Pete, because Pete was someone that I was not particularly high on entering this season, although I did like his place within his own tribe, certainly. But Pete, certainly, I really liked how he came across. We didn't see a ton of Pete, and perhaps it was just because I really liked that line you pointed out where it's like, well, we'll see what happens when we get fire. I really did like that, and maybe that's just sticking with me, and that's why I like him so much. But I think you're right, which is he is a guy who, despite – because the interviews I saw, you just talked about Jersey, but he is a guy who I think has like an engineering degree, which at least requires some level of competence, and I think we saw that, and certainly like hints of it.
Yeah, I don't know if everybody out there knows what an engineering degree entails. It's usually like 37 to 40 weeks, 40 hours per week of homework, let alone the 25, 30 hours of classes that you're taking. You have to be diligent to be an engineer. And I think that shows that Pete is probably not going to give up the fight at any point during this game. He's not going to forget about what he's doing, like so many people do. And, you know, he's also young and male, which means he's chock full of testosterone, which also kind of goes towards that same theme. The one thing I think he has going against him is that he's in a tribe with two really physically strong older males who are going to bond. And that could make him the first male out if Scoopin can organize things well enough to eventually turn on him. I think we've seen little glimpses of Artis and Scoopin bonding. You know, they haven't shown us very much Artis, but pretty much every scene he's been in has been him joking around with Scoopin. And so, you know, being the one guy out of three, it could potentially mean he's on the outskirts. I don't think it's going to happen though. I think Pete's going to go pretty far with RC and Abby Maria and whoever else happens to come along for the ride.
Yeah, I agree. I think RC and Abby Maria, based on edit primarily, I would say at this point, they are both very visible, and I think they're going to be pretty long-term characters. One thing I wanted to ask you specifically about Gary, and I'm very curious to hear what you have to say about this as someone who's as into poker as you are, because I'm assuming you had something of a similar thought when we heard Scoopin talking about how he wanted to go basically with the flow of the game and basically take what his tribe gives him, which I'm sure you also drew the parallel to kind of like in poker, you want to take what the table gives you, basically. Did you have any thoughts about this kind of idea? Because I really like this coming from Scoopin.
It's funny because I did not make a poker parallel there. The parallel I made there was to Sandra. I'm an advocate of Sandra's. I believe that Sandra plays a very smart game and that she more than just about anybody goes with the flow of the game. And I think it's a very smart strategy. I don't know if it's a possible strategy to pull off for a guy as front and center as Michael Scoopin. You know, it's not like he's going to be just the one lounging on the beach. He's the one who's going to draw the attention to him. And so it's hard to go with the flow of a game that you're the center of attention of. But I think it's a sound strategy, and if he can pull it off, it's a hopeful victory.
Yeah, I think the idea of adjusting to the rest of your competition is a very, very sound one in fundamental like game theory, and I will certainly give Sandra credit for that. I think you're absolutely right that she does that, and she's very typically usually in tune with like what's happening within the tribe. So certainly praise Sandra for that, and not get further into Sandra. So one of the other things we see here is Scoopin keeps hurting himself, which we talked about Pete's line there, but I thought this was pretty funny and kind of interesting that despite one of the more graphic injuries in Survivor history, him kind of still not really caring, playing fast and loose with the machete, I guess.
Yeah, I was laughing pretty hard at that. I thought the whole thing was pretty fun. I think some people fear bumps and bruises more than others. Obviously, Michael Scoopin is not one of them. I guess it lowers his equity a little bit because it increases the chance that he might actually lose the game again. But other than that, I don't think it has much of an effect. If nothing else, I think it humanizes him a little bit, which makes him great for TV. And maybe it humanizes him enough that people aren't afraid of facing the legend until like they've figured out that they don't want to do that.
Yeah, I think you're right that it humanizes him. And it's certainly, this is an obligatory segment. If Scoopin hurts himself early, you have to show it.
Yeah, absolutely. No question.
So one thing I actually want to go back to very briefly that we talked about a little bit is artists, because as you mentioned, we didn't see a lot of artists here. We saw him joking around a little bit, and I had thought, and there were some comparisons to like Philip Shepard 2.0, and I think it certainly that is off the table now. And I think basically for episode one for artists, because he was someone, when we were talking to Gordon had him at the bottom of his power rankings ultimately when reading that article. And I think no news was good news, basically, for artists here, that isolating himself.
It's good news on the short term, it's bad news on the long term.
Right, yeah. But in terms of clearing himself as chef. Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, we keep doing that. He's not going to win the game. He's not going to get eliminated right away. He might eventually become a little bit more visible, or he'll get the Purple Rick treatment. Where suddenly he shows up at Final Five with a mustache, and we're saying, well, who the hell is that guy?
Sorry I keep talking over you. I agree.
It's going to happen.
Yeah. I like you said, I think he's too low visibility to be a really big winner contender anytime soon in that first episode, but I think he could be around for a while. I don't think we have any reason to believe anyone wants him out anytime soon.
I think on your last episode, it was speculated that he might be the first one to go from this tribe. It certainly seems more likely now that it'll be Lisa than him. The fact that they didn't even draw any attention to him suggests that he's around for a little while. I guess ultimately, we don't, as much as they like to play tricks with us and make us believe that there's a chance that the Russell Swans are going to go home over the Zane Jackasses, even these, especially with a six-person tribe, you can't forget the importance of physical strength.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dom, what did you think about Artis, if you have any thoughts on him?
He didn't really show up enough in the episode for me to have any thoughts about him. Other than that, I agree that there's no reason why he should go, but just numerically, like there aren't really any other options. If this alliance between RC, Admiral Maria, Pete, and Scoopin comes together, and Scoopin looks to be trying to protect Lisa, then there literally is no other option.
Yeah, that's totally possible. Like, if Scoopin really does, because we saw him, Scoopin was the one, apparently, on his tribe to recognize her as Blair Warner, and he says something to her, and he kind of wants her to come out about it, and we hit on this a little while ago, where he's kind of saying, well, might it be helpful, which I think is a very tactically sound way to say, I think you should tell people, and she says it would be hurtful, and then he backs off from it, because he recognizes, of course, she doesn't want to tell people. But if he did seem like he really wanted to keep her, despite her being clearly the one on the outs, I would say. So, like Don mentioned, if that does come back into play, then perhaps we could see Artis go first. Although I think at the end of the day, I agree with Gary that we just saw so much more of Lisa, and I think there are more reasons to vote out Lisa, so that if Tandang ever does end up going to a tribal council, I think Lisa would be the one to go. And now if we want to talk about a little bit about what we see Tandang going forward, Gary, would you say that would be the most likely scenario for you if they end up going to tribal council?
Yeah, like, I think that generally speaking, the people who get the most focus in the early episodes are long-term protagonists, or short-term evictees. You know, we see people, you know, who are really gonna drive the action interacting with the people who ultimately fall by the wayside when going up against them. So it just seems to me like artists for the moment is probably pretty safe. Like, if you were to ask me to put money down on anybody, I'm obviously putting it on Lisa. You know, and, you know, last week they showed her, or sorry, not last week, with this episode, the preview for a second for episode two, they showed her doing the whole, am I really made to play this game, you know, shtick, and, you know, that's really not an attitude that's going to make her endear herself any more to her tribe mates. So, you know, I think Scoopin, given his philosophy that he expressed, you know, as much as he seems to want to play with her and knows that teaming up with someone from his generation might be a smarter thing to do than the young kids, I think he's going to go with the game enough that if the rest of them really want her gone, then she's going to be gone.
Okay, yeah, I can certainly agree with that, I think. And again, we don't want to read too much into edit just yet, but first I certainly have to mention, I am totally in love with RC, which I'm sure is shocking. But I'm really liking her this season. I think she's going to be around for a long time. I think this tribe is going to be in pretty good shape for a while, and I think they're going to be some big protagonists from this tribe this season.
I'd be happy with RC if nobody ever said anything funny around her.
Yeah, seriously, thank you. Say, Colin, I can turn you on by just by going, kill.
That's true. Well, when you're as delusional as me when it comes to people like RC, you just kind of tune that stuff out.
The problem is, she also seems to think that what she says is funny as well. So you hear something which, on its own, is perfectly sensible, but then punctuated by this hyena-like screaming.
Maybe it's not as noticeable in person when you're focused on the game and so on, so maybe it allows her, like, she to escape by it. I have to think that there are going to at least be a couple people there for whom it's going to be grating. And, you know, it, as silly as it is on a strategic level, that's often the deciding factor between someone staying and someone going home, like becoming a target. Say, okay, I really just don't want that person around me anymore. They're hurting my ears. I'm just going to vote for them. I don't think it's going to happen on this tribe. I think she's really secure on this tribe because, you know, she is a real physical threat as far as the lays go. But yeah, I could see her, you know, just, I don't know, she grates. She actually really reminds me on some strange level of Eliza Orleans, mm-hmm. who was obviously far more neurotic and far less confident and, you know, just a different person. But there's something about her that just screams the same thing to me, that she could eventually just alienate herself from her tribe.
Well, yeah, she's a really smart chick who's really, really confident. Much like Eliza, I would say.
You and I interpret Eliza differently then. I don't think Eliza's that confident a person.
Okay, I think Eliza is certainly less confident than RC, but I think Eliza is confident in her own abilities. She has a more fragile ego.
Right, but usually that kind of self-confidence is a way of masking other insecurities, whereas I think RC is just a genuinely bold, smart person.
Yeah, I think she's a woman who's been successful in life and just carries herself that way. I agree with that. But I don't know, there's just something about her that mirrors Eliza. I haven't put my finger on it yet. I know that's not very good for analysis sake. We'll see if she's able to, like, if she keeps the role that she's in. You know, again, she's being very aggressive. And, you know, like, obviously the three team split makes that more beneficial, but I don't think aggressive moves this early in the game are usually beneficial as a whole. You know, I think that, you know, I think the scooping approach is probably better. But we don't know if that'll agree.
What do you make of the female casting recently? Because we're coming off two seasons where we've had cerebral, just focused female winners. And it seems like, well, we don't want to make too many assumptions after the first episode, but RC could certainly fit that mold.
I love I'm not a fan of the models. I'm a big believer in the idea that the internet provides whatever you need with regards to sexy women.
That's a fair stance.
I don't understand people who watch Survivor for hot chicks, quote unquote, because they're dirty and they smell horrible. You know, like, and sure, some of these women are attractive, but, you know, you can find them in cleaner environments. So I don't quite get it. And maybe that's just me getting old. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I'd rather see real women in, You know, I'd rather see, you know, the winners from the last 2 years. I'd rather see, you know, smart ladies. Even if, you know, even with me not liking RC, I'm happy to see a strong, aggressive woman, you know, playing the game. Because, you know, I think that we have all these GOAT discussions, and Poverty makes it in, and Sri makes it in, and that's it. And, you know, you have people dumping on Amanda Kimball all the time, despite the fact that she's, to me, very clearly amongst the top 10 women who have ever played the game. And disparaging in a lot of ways, you know, and women are discredited for their looks and treated as lesser players for their looks sometimes. And I think it's great that Survivor is casting real strong women who can topple those kinds of, the image problems that bikini models will bring to the game. I don't love that they cast, beauty pageant, participants every season. I don't like that they cast actors and actresses every season. I think part of what made Survivor so attractive in the early going was that Sue Hawk was this mean, kind of ugly, trashy lady who went out there and was able to play this game against a doctor, play this game against, you know, a big fat gay guy and against a Navy SEAL. And, you know, that was cool to me. And, don't get me wrong, I still love Survivor. I'm always going to love Survivor. But I do miss the grungy people doing grungy, real challenges aspects of the game instead of shiny people doing obstacle courses.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that Sophie's win was embraced as a reaction to that was that I think she's the first young woman they've cast in a long time that isn't conventionally attractive. And that's not meant to bag on Sophie. It's just it doesn't fit into that kind of stereotypical mold that the producers like to cast people in.
Yeah, I agree with that. And again, she had physical capability beyond, you know, the stick woman and so on. I love the Sophie casting call. I really do. I think it's I just want to see as great a variety of interesting people as we can. Like, do you guys remember, like, Dom, you weren't watching the first season, but Colin, do you remember the first couple of seasons reading the bios of the people who were playing on the show? Like, they were all superhuman. And at the same time, they're all very relatable. You know, and, you know, as an example with Angie's not relatable to me. You know, she's cute. She's adorable. Don't get me wrong. But she's not relatable. She's not Colleen.
Yeah. You know, sorry if I can cut in. What they used to do with the hot girls is they'd have, you know, Colleen, I'm spacing now on what Colleen's occupation was, but like Elizabeth was a shoe designer, and then like Darrow was a mortician. You know, you had Jenna and Heidi in there in Amazon, but I would say, I think most people would agree that they may have like kind of detracted. Like the models really haven't, over the course of Survivor history, done a ton of great for the show, I would say, as most people would probably interpret it. And I agree with Gary in the sense that like, I'm not sure who's so dead set on like, I must have a model to look at in a bikini at all times or I will not be tuning in. Because like you mentioned, you can get that anywhere. And secondly, these girls do not stay day three looks for too long. But I think they used to get, certainly in my mind, equally attractive girls that were also just normal girls that lived life and were like fun and weren't pageant girls.
See, and that's the thing. Like, if I have to hear one more pageant girl talk to me about how they're accustomed to competition and, you know, and getting their hands dirty, it's like, no, give me a break. You're in a pageant because you're stunning and beautiful. You don't the idea that every single one of them has a real feel for what it is like to be Dana, go through life as Dana, or Dreams, or any of the other really gritty people who have been on this show. You know, it just doesn't strike me as the same realm of reality.
No, I think there's certainly a section of society for that kind of person. Listen, these are girls who can live their entire lives without ever being told no, hearing nothing about how beautiful they are, and be totally happy with that. It's just not something I want on Survivor.
Right. Like, you know, we're generalizing a little bit, and I'm sure that individually some of them don't fit into this very square hole that we're creating for them. You know, but ultimately we've had enough of them, and we've seen time and time again that they just don't play the game. And I want people who are going to play the damn game.
Like, yeah, and I think
we've had our Natalie Tenorelli, okay? We watched her just sit there and watch the best player of all time dominate the game and use her as support. You know, and frankly, it ruined that season for me. You know, because suddenly Boston Rob had a three-vote block. And he could do whatever he wants. It actually hurts the game.
Yeah, and people say that that's now like, oh, well, you should take that into consideration and get them on your side early. It's part of the game now. And I think it's a very unnecessary part of the game. And,
that's a legitimate argument. And all you have to do to make that happen is be on Survivor three times before, get yourself a Red Sox hat, and be incredibly friggin' charming.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you got to do. And everybody has the option to do those things, except that they don't. You know, it just creates an unlevel playing field.
Yeah, okay. So I think if we're ready now to move on to the next tribe up for bids, this being, and I'm going to try to, I think Probe said it something along the lines of Kalabau. I'll work on that pronunciation, but this is the tribe, the red tribe. It's Penner, Jeff Kent, Dana, Katie, Dawson, and Carter. And one of the first things we saw happen, Gary, is Jeff Kent goes down with a knee injury. But more importantly, I think at this camp, is Jeff Kent and Dana start getting along and kind of start this anti-Penner sentiment, which seems to really click with the rest of the tribe. So what do you think about this?
Well, okay, two things. First of all, Jeff Kent was a really durable baseball player, played for 17 seasons, didn't have a lot of injuries. So the fact that he got injured literally within 3 minutes at the start of the game is pretty funny. Some might say karmic, but I'm not gonna debate. Yeah. The other thing that I find really funny is that here's this guy who has this history of not necessarily politically correct behavior, and we have this. You know, Dana seems like a nice enough girl. She said in her interview, her pregame interview, that she is gay, and she obviously carries herself with some pride in that regard. And she's looking to him for her kinship. I mean, it's a mess waiting to happen. I think it could eventually be explosive, and it could eventually be Penner's saving grace. If they have a frank conversation about her lifestyle, and Jeff Kent, being the outspoken son of a bitch that he is, voices his real thoughts on that lifestyle, and they're what we believe them to be, then that could cause a rift within this five-person quote-unquote family that seems to have formed on day two.
You don't think this could turn into the saccharine story that we always seem to get on Survivor, where it's, you're my first lesbian friend, and you've opened my eyes up to the diversity of the world?
I suppose it could, but it's not often that 45-ish-year-old men, alpha males, find themselves bending that way. Generally speaking, I think that 45-year-old alpha males want to bend the world to their whims.
Okay. What do you make of the fact that it seemed like Scorpion's tribe was the only tribe on which there wasn't any kind of anti-returning player sentiment?
I think that goes in part... I think that both Penner and Swan are obnoxious. While Scorpion, first of all, isn't obnoxious, and second of all, has a hero thing going for him. I think he's the only hero of the three.
Yeah, I guess the question is, do you think it's something about Scorpion, or is it just the tribe that he happened to end up with?
It's an interesting question. Well, I think generally speaking, it's going to be a case-by-case basis. Like, we saw that Kosh inspired the same reaction as Swan and Penner did, where, at the same time, Ozzy, they were like, holy crap, we've got Ozzy. So I think that charisma certainly plays into the responses. At the same time, you know, I made the comments earlier about the Island of Misfit Toys. I don't know if that's actually fair of these people. Like, you know, Carter's a pretty good-looking guy, and once her face model number two is an attractive girl, and Dawson obviously has some charm. So, like, these are people who are accustomed to not being, you know, outcast. As a matter of fact, Penner's kind of the nerd in a group of non-nerdy people. Dana is probably the exception to that rule. But so maybe the fact that he doesn't gel with them on that level is why, you know, he's kind of being outcast. You know, in addition, I'm sure his behavior isn't helping things either. Although, for what's worth, everything we saw of him other than the searching for the idol, he was being charming. He was being supportive. He was urging people to do stuff and saying good things about them when they did. You know, he gave Kent that thumbs up when he watched him from behind working on the shelter and stuff like that. You know, so, you know, we haven't really seen Penner rub people the wrong way. We've just seen that he has rubbed people the wrong way. But I get the feeling that was them creating a storyline for that tribe. I don't know if it's as pronounced as there is as the edit was making it look.
I think one contributing factor to the maybe why Scoopin's getting less heat and maybe why Penner and Swan are on the outs is kind of like with Coach and Ozzy last year, when you have the two tribes and that you cart them in without telling them which is going to be on which team, the natural inclination there is, oh, I want Ozzy because he's so good at these challenges. And then when one team ends up with Coach, it's like, oh, we got Coach. And in this case, I could see people saying, okay, well, there are these three guys. I want Scoopin. And so the team that gets Scoopin, the yellow team, I could then be more happy with Scoopin if he was. I would guess Scoopin at least would be the pick.
I think that's a valid point, and I also think that Scoopin's history is one of unifying his tribe.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's true of Scoopin and Swan, whereas Penner's the guy who jumped tribes.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I think that there's some reliability in Scoopin that may not have come with Penner, and you know, you're right, that may have been played up in their minds and in terms of gratefulness that they got the guy they did.
Yeah, and also Scoopin's extremely capable as like an outdoorsman, I think, and Penner's probably, you know, the wandering Jew.
Yeah, you know, speaking as a Jew, we're very good at the outdoors thing. We hire people to fix stuff. I obviously, again, very square hole, but I think obviously for the first few days, you really prefer to have Michael Scoopin and Jonathan Penner. That might have been playing into their attitude.
Yeah, and also just that reputation of, well, this is the guy who flipped tribes, at least in Cook Islands.
Right.
Yeah, you know, at least Dawson's a super fan. And speaking of Dawson, not only apparently a super fan of Survivor, but baseball, because she recognizes Jeff Kent, but chooses not to, like, blow up his spot, at least not until she feels she can, you know, use it as some kind of, like, leverage, I guess. What did you think about this?
I thought that was very smart, and I was pleasantly surprised, because her pregame interview left me with the impression that she was going to be a blabbermouth, that she was going to get herself into trouble. And I think that the first inclination is to say, hey, aren't you Jeff Kent? And the fact that she had the savvy to not do that, you know, bodes better for her than I expected. I think the reality is that if you have somebody who is pseudo-famous and they, for whatever their reasons, choose not to recognize their own pseudo-fame, and then you call them out on that, you're immediately putting a target on yourself in their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm Jeff Kent and I don't want anybody to know who Jeff Kent is, and this girl with these neon shoelaces and pink shirt comes with a big honking smile on her face and says, I know who you are, I'm like, okay, great. Hey, Dana, Carter, let's vote out Dawson.
Yeah. Don, you know, what'd you... Oh, yeah, totally.
So, Don, yeah, it's smart that she didn't.
Yeah, Tom, do you agree generally with that? Because I feel like I honestly would have been like, I wouldn't have recognized him. I would know the name Jeff Kent, but if I would had been out there with like Brett Favre or something, like, hey, Brett Favre, that's awesome. You're on my team.
I mean, maybe. Like, Dawson doesn't seem like the type of person who's going to just become a rabid fangirl over some minor celebrity. So I'm not surprised that she reacted that way. Although
probably a minor celebrity, though. No. He was like. By winning the most valuable player trophy, like he was a superstar in the game, and he played for 17 years. Like,
sure,
yeah. Baseball's still a pretty big part of American culture.
Right.
I certainly would not call him D-list.
Okay, I'm not trying to like demean his accomplishments or anything. I think if this you was
progressed or Kent Dom.
I guess my point is, if this season was held 17 years ago in Jeff Kent's prime, then obviously yes, this would be an issue. But the fact that the issue of him being recognized is even something which becomes a question because some people might not recognize him shows that, you know, it, in some ways it's self-confirming. Like, it's not as big of an issue as it could have been.
But I really think that anybody who thinks they can hide these kind of secrets from 17 strangers is really fooling themselves.
No one's ever done it in the history of any of these shows. I don't know why they're doing it.
You know, at least, you know, okay, I give Kent credit for at least having a secret worth keeping. Like, there were people in past seasons who, like, oh, what was the male model last year with the squeaky voice?
Jay Byers.
Jay, thank you. Jay lying about the fact that he was a model, for example. Oh, a model? No, I'm a photographer's assistant.
Yeah.
Do people really not realize that if they tell a lie, they have to maintain it for 39 days? Like, that's really hard when you're talking about every person you're allowed to interact with for the next 39 days, you have to keep a lie intact. You know, it's just, you know, in Ken, you know, back to Ken for a minute. Within the first, like, 30 minutes of the episode, he identified himself as a rancher, and then he said that he makes his money from selling motorcycles.
Now, one other thing that we should probably talk about is Penner goes idol hunting here. You know, he's a veteran. He knows there are idols in play. Jeff made it clear on the boat that idols were in play. And he ends up thinking, okay, what were we left with here? And he does the math. Okay, well, the rice is something that they gave us, like a machete and rice. So he goes through the rice and finds the bag. And we'll also talk more about this when we talk about Russell Swan, because he does the same thing. What did you make of this about Penner? Because idol hunting has been something that has generally been frowned upon early in Survivor by most people, or at least hypocritically, at the very least, in most tribes. So what did you think about this?
I think idol hunting early on is generally suicidal, but sometimes it's not much of a choice. I get the feeling that we weren't shown the entire story there, that Penner might have, for whatever reason, felt like he was on the outskirts. Because Penner is a social animal, so for him to be separating himself from his tribe, there may have been, you know, something on the cutting room floor, you know, to the effect of, oh, look at those five huddling together and chatting and looking my general direction and sneering and making throat-slitting motions. You know, maybe I should go search for the idol. I don't recall, but I don't, 100%, but I don't think that Penner went hunting, like, idol hunting on the first day in Fans versus Favorites. And, you know, if I'm correct on that, then obviously we have a different dynamic in play here that has him doing that kind of a hunt. I don't know. I don't see why he would. I think, especially with the record that returning players have, you know, like, obviously you can play up, I'm a returning player, guys, stick with me for just a little while. I'll at least get you through the first few episodes. You know, we've never seen a returning player get voted out, like, first out of their tribe. You know, and so obviously there's some value to his having been here before that should be obvious to them. And so for him to abandon that value and instead go hunting for the idol, which I think idols are a little bit overrated anyways, especially since they draw a target to you anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's something else at work here that we didn't see.
I think the idea of having it, if you could say, I'll give you an idol right now and you don't have to go looking for it. You would definitely want one in your own back pocket if you could keep it to yourself. But the practice of going out and looking for the idol, I think, and putting yourself maybe in harm's way and getting that kind of reputation. One thing I want to definitely get out.
Here's the thing, though. If he finds the idol, what happens? He has to play it the first time, right? Because they know he's been searching for it. And so the first time they go to tribal council, they're going to try. They're going to hope that he hasn't found it and they're going to flush it out.
Well, no, because whenever they do that, they know that each of them individually, there's a risk that they could be going home. I think we see this a lot where people are reluctant to pull the trigger on flushing an idol because even though in theory there's a very small chance that it's going to be specifically them, in their own mind that chance is higher than mathematically should be. And, like, obviously the repercussions of that, if it happens, are drastically bad.
Yeah, I guess, but, like, I don't know, like, maybe it's because I'm a multi-level game thinker, but my logic is going to be, we've never seen somebody who found an idol before their first tribal council actually play it at the first tribal council, so why not just vote for them?
Did Christina Kell do, and not to shit on your point completely, but I feel like I think Christina Kell did at least maybe at the first or second one, but apart from that, no, I can
see
that.
Did she give her idol to Boston Rob?
No, the problem with examples like that is, often in times like that, there is a majority on the tribe that has the numbers to flush out the idol in such a way that even if it's played, there's no risk to the people in that majority. The trouble here, though, is that given that you only have six people, it's very easy to say, let's say Penner votes for some random person. It's going to be difficult to configure the votes in such a way that you actually know what's going to happen. Like, it's very easy for one person to switch their vote and suddenly everything's gone haywire.
Mm.
Yeah, well, one thing I want to get out there, I want to get it on the record now. Obviously, the idol is the thing on top of the rice box, right?
It seemed like that's what they were showing us. I didn't get a great look at it.
Yeah, because I feel like that would be, if I was ever out there, I would just tear through, you know, as covertly as possible, like, all the different, like, ornamentation on the camp, around the camp, basically. And that would certainly be high. If I found the clue in the rice box and saw that thing on top of the rice box, I'd yank it off and at least check.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I feel like they're I don't think that's some kind of like genius pick. I feel like that's what they're trying to show us. Like, oh, look how close he was to actually getting it. Anyway, so Gary, I guess the big question is, what do you see? Do you think Penner's in any kind of trouble if they end up having to go to tribal council?
I don't think he's the first one out of this tribe.
Who is?
I think Dana.
Oh, wow. What, on what grounds?
I think that no, maybe either Dana or Kent. I think that I don't see the two of them getting along in the long haul. Okay. And I think that's going to create a rift, and I think that's going to draw some attention away from Penner.
All right, that's interesting. Dom, what do you think about what's going to go down if they have to go to tribal council?
Yeah, I think it's going to be one of Daniel or Kent, but specifically because when you have a tribe this small, any kind of two-person conflict, the importance of it becomes magnified. Like, it's impossible for the other people to ignore it at that point. So I feel like people are going to be forced to pick a side if that does turn into a real thing, and then whichever one of them is on the losing end of that equation is going to be the one who goes.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I could see them, and I agree, Gary, I don't think it's going to be a 39-day Bosch and Hatch kind of like buddy-buddy despite different political views situation. I could see them perhaps sticking together for a little while, though, and I would have pegged like Katie as the first boot out, but I don't think, again, and not to read too much into the edit, that that's necessarily what's going to happen. I think Jeff Kent's going to be the first one out of this trap.
The thing is, Katie's not the one who's ever going to stir the pot, and I think the first elimination from a given tribe is generally, you know, the kind of people who do that, who draw attention to themselves, often negative attention, or even not negative attention, but just sort of put a bullseye on their head by being loud. I don't think Katie's that person.
When we were talking to Gordon, we were talking about, you know, maybe Katie's the first boot, maybe some kind of group forms where the others hit it off that are not named Jeff Kent or Katie. But Jeff Kent could survive one because of his physical strength, maybe with this knee thing. If he's still rubbing people the wrong way and his knee's no good, I could see him. I think that may be the most likely situation as he ends up going.
Yep.
All right. Yeah. So I think we're good on.
I can see an evacuation of Kent eventually.
Oh, yeah?
I think he's a really determined dude. You know, again, I go back to the alpha thing. I don't think he's a guy who's ever going to want to admit defeat. But I could see that knee becoming a real issue.
Okay, well, keep an eye out on that, guys. So if we move now on to the final tribe, and this is the tribe that we end up seeing to go to tribal council, but we'll get to that. This is the Matt Singh tribe. This is Russell Swan, Malcolm, Roxanne, Denise, Angie, and Zane. I'm sure we all have a bunch to say about this tribe. And I think the first thing to really get into is that Russell Swan does not want to be the leader of this tribe and wants everyone to be a team, at least allegedly.
Oh, shit.
So, exactly. Well, let's get right into that, Gary.
He said at the beginning of the episode, these people have to run with me or I'm going to run them over. If that's not, like, how are you defining leadership?
I say,
period. Like, hello. Like, don't get me wrong, it's not leadership, you know, of magnanimous kind, but it's certainly a brand of leadership. You know, strikes me as very, not say tongue-ish. you know, it's, I don't know. After this episode, I just feel like Russell Swan is a ridiculous person.
Yeah, I swear, we saw more of Russell Swan in this one episode than we saw in all of Samoa.
Right. It feels kind of like the Rupert edit, where the first time around, we just saw him smiling and big and strong. And he was likable in that regard. Not necessarily relatable, but likable. And then the second time around, sorry, Rupert was obviously relatable in the way they portrayed him the first time. But anyways, the second time around, they had already made the hero, so now they felt like they could show some cracks with the edit. And holy crap, the cracks in Swan. He's awkward. He's a dork. He can't help but order people around and do everything, despite his protestations to the fact, to the idea of his being a leader. Like, just his behavior is so clearly alienating. You know, like, it just, you know, putting your hands in someone's face when they try to interject with their opinion, when they're trying to play survivor, shush. Like, seriously, who wants to be spoken to that way?
Yeah. No, you know, I agree.
Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
I agree entirely. It seemed like an entirely different Russell Swan to me. Dom, what did you think about Russell Swan 2.0 compared? Because, again, in Samoa, he just seemed like the friendly leader who ran bad at the end. Early, but at the end for him.
I think it's tempting to describe Russell Swan 2.0 as a downgrade, but I think all of these qualities were present in him in Samoa, but we just didn't have a chance to see them be exhibited to the degree that they were in seemingly 3 days this time around.
They weren't all exhibited. Like in Samoa, we never saw him try really hard to be funny and just turn out to be awkward instead.
Yeah, that he had that one confessional where he was talking about, I'm going to let the other guy, I think this is what you're talking about, where he's, I'm going to let the other guy leave.
I want to be a theater. We see where that gets us. You know, it's like, dude. I'm a man who self-deprecates with my humor a lot. And I understand, you know, where self-deprecating humor comes from. But self-deprecating humor isn't really funny when it's unfunny. Like, it's not humor when it's not funny. You know, like, it's just, I don't know. I just felt like there were crickets chirping whenever he spoke in any way that was attempting to be colorful. And it was just a really awkward edit for him.
I agree. Yeah, it was a, I don't know what to think about his odds long term, and I'm sure as we talk more about the tribe, we'll be getting into that. And actually, let's move to someone who I'm sure we're all pretty excited to talk about, and I can't believe his name hasn't come up yet, that being Malcolm. Gary, what did you have to see, what did you have to say now that you've seen Malcolm in action?
I have a habit of trying to fight against the notion that preseason favorites are actually really favorites. I fought against the idea of Kim as the favorite forever. I bet against her repeatedly, and I just got my ass kicked all season for that. And I kind of came up with the same attitude towards Malcolm. And I think that Malcolm now is in a bit of a rougher spot because he's on the five-person tribe instead of a six. But, yeah, he's really likable, and he's really charming, and he's really collected. The way he – like, what we saw, his first strategic interaction that we saw was with Angie – he just kind of said, let's just do what Russell wants for now. And with that one simple line, not only does he plot out her game on his behalf, but he also makes her feel like she's in on something. Right?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Side of that insight. It's really smart. I really like him. I don't know if he'll win. Like, obviously, we don't know he's winning. I don't know if he's the favorite. Just because... you know, the five-person tribe thing, and I see this tribe continuing to fall apart a little bit. And if that happens, I think in the past with three-tribe games, they divided up the disintegrating tribe. I think that's really bad for the members of that tribe. In a three-team season, I would prefer to see them do a two-team swap than have the third team split up. You know, I want a complete reorganization. But if we don't get that, then Malcolm could be in a lot of trouble because he's the guy who's going to get targeted.
Yeah, totally. We talked a little about that with Gordon, about the idea of if they do it like they did in All-Stars with the three tribes where one just gets disintegrated, what it resulted in last time is Boston Rob just getting to pick who he got to drag along to the end with him. And it would certainly be much better, I would say, for a game perspective, which is kind of like what you're saying, where they make two new tribes with combinations of, you know, two or three people from each of the three tribes on each of the two tribes.
Right.
Okay, yeah, we heard something along the same lines from Gordon when we were talking to him about how he just had pessimistic with regard to Matt Singh. I think, not a great first episode for them. They kind of got killed in the challenge, although that may have been partially due to Zane, who, Gary, you will definitely get your chance to talk about Zane. I don't know. I still feel like now they've got kind of this core of people, most specifically Malcolm and Denise. I feel like those two are super, super capable. And actually, if we want to transition a little bit into Denise now, and I'm sure we'll talk about that combination of the two of them as we do this. We were high on Denise before the season started. Loved Denise. Gary, what'd you think about Denise?
Yeah, same thing. I found her perspective on Zane to be remarkable and refreshing and unexpected. You know, I knew coming in that she was an educated woman, but, you know, for her to look into the tattoos and find their meaning – to me was really impressive. You know, talk about not judging a book by its cover. It so happens that this book's cover was completely inaccurate. You know, it was Archie. For her to look at those Bible verses and look at the certain things that were on his skin and decipher what those might mean and be curious to learn more, I think that makes her a pretty remarkably insightful person. Certainly above the mean. And, you know, I like her going forward. I wonder if she might be a little bit naive with, you know, she looks for the good in people, it seems. And I think that might not be the best quality in this game. I think in Survivor you want to look for the bad. I think she's a really interesting person to have on the show. Also, by the way, looking at the group photo, like the cast photo from before the season, I had no idea she was so tiny. She's a tiny little person.
Yeah, Malcolm looked to be about a full foot taller than her for pretty, when they like hugged her, when they were doing their like fist pump, which turned into a hug for their, team handshake or whatever. He towered over her, and I don't think he's like 6'4" or anything. He looks like he's about 6'1".
Yeah, well, looking at this photo, she's about 4 inches, 5 inches shorter than Roxy.
Yeah.
She's shorter than Abby Maria, who looks like a tiny person in the photos. Like, she's definitely the smallest person on the cast. She's up to Scoopin's shoulders. She's up to Zane's chin. Like, she's a really little person. And so, obviously she's physically fit, but I'm curious to see how she'll fare in challenges that are more about, you know, pure brute strength than, you know, the typical endurance challenges that women seem to really thrive in.
Yeah, I liked very much that Malcolm kind of recognized, okay, she's a therapist. She's someone who's very used to removing her emotions from a situation and taking an analytical approach, which I think is an extremely accurate assessment on his part. And I really dig that kind of, they both strike me as thinkers and people who like to think and who think correctly, really. I think like with clarity and objectively and objectivity, I guess. And I have extremely high hopes for these two moving forward.
Yeah. What do you think of, though, about what I said about her thinking about looking for the good in people a little too much?
I agree. I think, when you're on a six-person tribe, I think it certainly any effort you can make to find a way to connect with people is fine. And I love her idea of, you know, he has like a death date and then the serenity prayer on his tattoo or among his tattoos. You can kind of extrapolate from that. Okay, you know, he's lost someone close to him. Perhaps he's an addict or a former addict. And that's something that, as a therapist, I'm sure she looks for all the time. And it's certainly a good, I agree. I think she'll come down on that as time goes on and she begins to become more wary of people and have more reason to question people. But right off the bat, I think she comes across certainly like she's looking for the good in people. And I think that's a good thing for people to see, coming off of her. Like, I think they're going to be more inclined to connect with her on that basis. But, you know, it could certainly, end up being her downside and her downfall. If we end up seeing, you know, if Malcolm is truly Heideck, she could be like Helen.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dom, what do you have to say about Denise?
Yeah, I was a big fan of Denise just based on the pregame stuff, and I'm an even bigger fan of her having watched the premiere. And, yeah, I was going to ask Gary, based on the comment he made about her maybe being too trusting, is this going to be building up to Malcolm knifing her in the back at some point?
It could, or it could lead up to... Like, the thing is, obviously, just... Through the journey that she's had getting to this point in her life, like, I have to think that she's encountered some negative, you know, to go with the positive. She obviously is a person who's looking for it, but maybe, you know, as we see backstabs occur, like, she'll awaken, because she's obviously a very, like, a clever woman. You know, obviously is a strong word, but she sure seems to be a very clever woman. And so, like, she might watch Malcolm orchestrate one or two backstabs and say, well, hey, I have to look out for that myself. But, yeah, it certainly seems like, you know, Malcolm's going to hurt somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point, I have to think that's going to happen. It might be her, it might be Angie. You know, it's probably one of the two of them. But, you know, it's possible. I don't think Angie's going to be a person who's going to see it coming. Denise might.
Okay, well, I think certainly if the edit is any indication here, the Russell Swan kind of era as the hero of this tribe was very short-lived, and I think these two, Malcolm and Denise, are going to be like the long-term kind of stars of this tribe and really running things as long as this group stays intact. But, you know, we bring up Angie now. Let's talk about the other people on this tribe, because there are certainly other people worth talking about. So, Angie, what'd you make of Angie? Because she seemed to be, you know, pretty active to me and more visible than, for instance, Katie, the other, like, hot girl of the season.
Yeah, you know, we've seen a lot of Purple Kellys recently, and I thought that Angie was going to be another one. And I thought the fact that she was actually, you know, not personable, because I don't think any of those women have been personable, but dynamic enough and interesting enough to actually make it, you know, have their voices make it into an edit. You know, I found that to be surprising and kind of refreshing. She seems like a sweet girl. I don't think she's winning this game. You know, I put pretty good money up against her winning this game. But, you know, obviously, you know, has her charms, and I think that'll carry her to an extent. You know, she could easily take the Tenorelli, role here. But again, you know, she's like trying so hard to bring Zayn along and pump him up, and that's really sweet, but, you know, ultimately it's like, you know what? Couldn't you just be using that time to go and actually make a better relationship with Russell Swan? Because that seems like it would be benefiting you a lot more in the long run. I didn't get the sense from what Gordon was saying about her that she was the energizer by any. Like, I didn't feel like she was like Red Bull times six. Like, I felt like he was just saying, this is a person whose personality glows. Like, she's sweet, she's stunning, you know, she's not, you know, she's not abrasive, but she's not quiet. Like, she just kind of sparkles a little bit, as, you know, as any good pageant girl should. You know, and I felt like he was just saying that she had an effervescent quality to that effect. And, you know, I think we saw some of that. Like, you know, because she, you know, she was, you know, like, she's obviously, you know, as much as a 20-year-old girl can be attractive to me, she's a beautiful girl. They don't have the life experience for my tastes. But, you know, it goes beyond just looking good. You know, Purple Kelly looked good, but who cared? You know, she actually said stuff that actually mattered. And that was kind of, you know, I don't necessarily expect any 20-year-old to ever say anything that I think is going to matter.
Well, okay. Dom, happy birthday coming up, by the way.
Seriously, you're not sort of as old as I am. I'm 39 years old. When you're 39 years old, you have a certain amount of life experience, and when somebody who's 20 years old tells you what's up, you're like, well, where the hell are you coming from? You don't know anything. You're 20 years old. But, like, no, seriously, when she spoke her mind, it didn't make me say, well, you're 20. Who cares? You know, which was surprising for me. Because especially a 20-year-old who looks the way she does, like, I don't expect her to have any basis in reality with regards to her opinion about anything.
Oh, you know, I
apologize for that. But it's just kind of, you know, it's what we carry with us, or at least what I carry with me. And, you know, so the fact that she was more than just a hairdo was refreshing.
Completely. I was way into Angie on this episode, and I apparently for the scenes from next week, we may see a little more of Angie, perhaps like in the context of Fang's heating up with Malcolm, which could get interesting. But yeah, I have to agree with what you were just saying, which is she it kind of blew my mind in terms of I thought she was going to be just silent and there, and she struck me. You know, Malcolm took to her early and said, you know, we're just going to listen to. Just pretend to listen whatever Russell says, and I didn't bring this up back then, but I definitely want to agree with what you said then, which is the way he phrased that is really brilliant, because in her mind it's then like, oh my God, I have a plan, and it's a plan with this guy, and we're in an alliance now, and he's cool, and that's awesome, without even needing her to agree to anything, and I think that could be a very beneficial relationship for her, and I think, I don't know how much of I think she's going to have far more cognizant awareness really than I was anticipating with regard to her own position in the game and her skills as a player. But I still think she could, you know, if she teams up with Malcolm and Denise and they go for a while, I could see her doing well and being there for a while. I don't know that she can win, but I'm very impressed with what I've seen so far relative to my expectations.
Did she say anything in her pregame about wanting to be in a partnership or a couple or anything like that?
She said one of her and Katie said they wanted to let the other one do that. I think it was actually Katie who said she wanted to let Angie do that.
Well, the reason I ask is because Malcolm's really the only viable candidate on their tribe. Like, you have, you know, crazy, excuse my saying so, but crazy Mantis Zayn.
Yeah.
And you've got, you know, a condescending older gentleman, Russell. And then you've got handsome young Malcolm. And so he's kind of a very natural fit if that's the kind of game she wants to play. So the fact that he's the one who said it to her may have also played into why she was so responsive to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that she's thinking about it on a conscious level like that, but maybe on a subconscious level it just makes so much sense for her to be with Malcolm. that that when he says anything to the effect of "I want to work with you," like she's only going to be like as receptive as humanly possible.
Yeah, no, I can actually I dig what you're saying. So another person I think that we should talk about is Roxanne. Now we didn't see too much of her, but what did you think about what we saw?
Roxanne? Oh, yeah. Roxy. I'm glad they didn't show her preaching. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that she has been preaching at times. I found her comments about Russell, you know, sort of causing her to reflexively go back into soldier mode to be very interesting. I think that she has too loose a mouth on her. I don't think she should have said that. You know, I think that it makes it'll allow people to know that she is manipulatable.
Okay, that's an interesting point. Yeah, you know, like basically what we know about Roxanne or Roxy going in. I was calling her Roxy before. Gordon was calling her Roxanne. I don't know. Hopefully, it's established soon one way or the other. Is that she's very religious and she has this military background. And really, what we saw out of her this episode is she knew who Russell Swan was before she saw him. So, and she went painted up with crosses to the challenge, and then she talked about her military background. So, I'm not sure how much more there we really learned about her, other than that's actually a pretty interesting idea that people may now view her as someone they can kind of steamroll.
Right.
Go ahead. Dom, do you have any thoughts on Roxanne / Roxy before we move on?
She seems like the sort of person who would be the locked first boot in a normal season or tribe, but it seems like on that scene, that level of dysfunction is almost normal, so she can kind of blend in, if that makes sense. I think Gary's point about people who stand out being the early targets is a good one, and Roxy's personality quirks or defects or whatever you want to call them don't make her stand out in Matt Singh as much as they would in some other tribe.
Okay. Yeah.
I also think that it's important to say, by the way, that I kind of guessed early on that there would be some kind of common ground found between Russell and Roxy. And the fact that it wasn't really shows you just how horrible Russell's behavior was for the first 3 days.
Okay. I kind of thought along the same lines, and that's I didn't necessarily arrive at that exact same conclusion, but I can certainly see that. I thought it was more I think Roxy is going to be someone who's kind of looking, not so much actively looking for someone to tell her what to do, but she's probably going to end up finding that being her role, which is I consider being someone who's like loyal to a fault.
I actually think that she might just look for somebody to tell her what to do.
I could see her being like Edna or Christina, where she's just trying to find someone to tell her what to do, and she's just going to do it until they inevitably take her out.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know that there's even much more to add about her. Which leaves us with just one person left. Now, Gary, this is someone I know you have plenty to say about because of something that I think is a great concept, this new game that you've come up with the NFL season kicking off. I'm sure many people are aware of NFL survivor pools where you pick over the course of a season one team each week to just not lose the game, and you can't pick the same team twice over the course of the season. And Gary came up with this idea of doing basically the same thing for Survivor. And, Gary, you want to get into that?
Yeah, so, you know, basically you pick one person who's not going to get eliminated that week, and then the next week you pick another person, with the only limitation being you can't pick anybody twice over the course of the game. And the last person still making picks is the winner. So, you know, if you play it relatively safe, then you should be fine. Now, I, for some reason that has now completely gone to me, thought that Zane was pretty safe for this week. You know, I think that with small tribes, you know, guys are more likely to be kept than girls. And I don't know, like they seem to be giving him enough airtime that he was be kept around a little bit. By the way, I thought that we were spoiled halfway through the episode. They did a player of the week thing and he was one of the three offered. I thought that meant that he was staying. So I was glad that they didn't spoil in that regard. But yeah, so anyways, back to so we called the concept of the game Survivor, because in football it's called Survivor Pool. And because I'm working a full-time job, and I'm doing poker stuff on top of that, and I'm still trying to maintain contact with my wife and my child, who are still back home for another couple of weeks, you know, things are pretty crazy busy for me right now. So really, when I came up with the idea, I just cut and pasted it to three different sources where I discussed Survivor. 2+2, a group on Facebook, and a group of friends who I do a pool with every year. And when I cut and paste, I just did the same. Like, you know, obviously, you know, varying your picks is a smart EV play. And if I had actually been thinking about it and had time to actually stop and actually say, well, who else do I want to pick, then I would have done that. But as it was, I was like, you know what? There's like a what? There's a 1 in 18 shot of a guy getting picked off this week. So whatever, I'm just going to pick Zane in all three pools. And so what I have done is create a format for a pool that everybody seems to be enjoying, at least, you know, in the preliminary discussion of it. And I don't get to play until 26, which really sucks. But hey, maybe people will enjoy it. I just, the entire episode on that level was just such, not the entire episode, but like, I started getting the feeling, right when Malcolm made the speech about how Zane had talked to everybody, I started getting a bad feeling. And watching everything after the challenge was slow motion. It was painful. Absolutely painful. Because it was a juxtaposition of Russell says something incredibly stupid that you don't think can be topped, and then here comes Zane saying something more stupid. Oh, I'm really going to get him now. I'm going to make them think I even want to go home more. It's like, what are you talking about? Just shut up. You have a guy who's painted a huge target on his chest, and all you have to do is shut up. And I grant that what we saw was him talking about his big plan and playing up with the fact that, you know, he deserves to go home. You know, the amount of it was, you know, it was 24 hours condensed into 20 minutes. But it's a hell of a lot for 24 hours in that 20 minutes. You know, and I'm guessing not all of it made it to the cut either. You know, they only have so many minutes to show us. You know, it was an hour and 2 minutes of footage for the episode. Like, you can only put so much Zane saying, send me home on the first friggin' vote, you know, in the episode. So, like, you know, I understand. There's actually a logic to what he was saying. It was like, you know, make sure that they like me, see how, you know, they're feeling about me, or some crap like that. But there's a point where you just say, okay, I planted the seed, now let's just let them bitch about Russell until they have to send him home. And even at Tribal Council, he was like, no, I deserve to go. You should send me. You know, like, holy shit, dude, shut up. Shut up. But he shut up, and so I just get to watch the game instead of playing it for us this evening.
It was, and I feel bad now laughing at your misery, but it was very, because this is, you know, we've had not a lot in the way of, like, fantasy survivor necessarily, and this is a very cool idea, I thought, and then to just get punished like that is just brutal. I think, a more conservative pick. I went with Carter on the grounds that, like, I just don't think they're ever going to vote him out on a six-person team this early, What's that?
I think Carter's going deep.
See, yeah, that was, I feel like, my logic, at least for Carter, was I don't think he's ever going to go out first, and I do want to at least be playing this game for a little while, because it does seem like fun, and I'm not very good at the NFL survivor pools. And I feel like Carter is going to be someone who's going to be harder to predict when he goes down the line, because I feel like it's going to come down to a lot of, oh, might he win this immunity, or might he not?
I think the only way Carter goes before the merge is if their tribe gets whittled down and then split up. I would save him for a few episodes. Like, I just think it's a bit of a spew to use him, like, to use the Carter card that early.
I would say it's a bit of a spew to go with Zane.
I would tell you, I'm not going to repeat on public radio or public podcasting, but I'll type them to you after.
No, I'm sure. No, Zane, I can totally understand. It seems like a bit of an oddball pick to be going first, I guess.
But, you know, at the same time, don't get me wrong, like, I'm sitting here being all bitchy, but I recognize the humor in the situation. It's obviously hilarious that I created this thing and I destroyed myself on a 6% shot on the first week. You know, like, it's like, for me to, first of all, pick the wrong guy, and second of all, do it for all three pools when I'm obviously an experienced enough gambler to know not to do that. Like, just, it's a comedy of errors. So, yep, you know, it is what it is, and I'll enjoy making fun of everybody else's picks for the rest of the season.
Yeah, see, I think my strategy for this is I'm basically just going to try to – I'm probably not going to win. I'm just going to try to stay in it for a while, and I'm sure that I'm going to eventually lose because either I'm just going to run out of people. I will have used everyone who's still left, I think.
Well, that's the thing. That's why I made that rule what it is. I think you have to be a little bit risky to win because if you use all the good people early, you're going to be left with the only people you've selected. So,
yeah,
Dominic, pick the first pick.
Yeah, I chose Roxy because it seemed like she is someone who could conceivably go first, and if so, then that's obviously really bad. But at the same time, if she lasts, then you get that you cut that card out early, and you don't ever have to use her again. If that makes sense. Like, I wasn't able to come up with the proper strategy, so I just went with a fairly intuitive pick.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's like you're kind of banking on having some people that you're gonna want to use down the line. So early on, you might want to not use those people up early. I can accept now that I think Carter was pretty spewy for the first episode. Yeah, all right. Well, a very interesting game. And Gary, I'm sure we're all gonna have a blast playing your game without you.
Thanks, buddy. There's actually already discussion of like of the strategy and the thread. And I like the way you describe it. You're essentially trying to pick whoever will go home next week to be your pick this week. Mm-hmm. Because you're not thinking about the next 6 weeks. You're thinking about the last 6 weeks and having people available to you. So
yeah,
I think it'll be cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, a little bit back to Zane and the rest of the Matsing tribe now. When they end up, you know, they didn't put in a great performance in the challenge. And Zane, as we talked about it, he comes up with this master plan basically to tell everyone he wants to leave. And then when they keep saying, oh, we want to take it, we want to keep you, we want to vote out Russell, he keeps then just telling them more reasons why he should leave. And this does not go as planned, his plan, that is. And he ends up getting voted out 5-1. And then on his way out, I thought it was funny, they cut to a shot of him walking down the path with his bag as his torch just been snuffed, and he's like, son of a bitch, like his move didn't work. So Gary, I ask you, is this the biggest first boot failure in Survivor history in terms of someone who was trying to stay in and could not?
It could be. It's a pretty massive failure. He certainly gave the producers enough fodder to go with it, you know, to make it a big one, the if you're not first, you're last quote from Talladega Nights.
Yeah, the chessboard thing where he said to king him.
Right, he really set himself up for a huge fall. I don't know. I think that all first evictees are equally sad. But he certainly seems like he put himself in a position where, like this might just be playful editing, you know, because we saw this last year with Cochran over and over and over again, where it looked like they were going home and then they weren't. And so it might just be that they were making it look like Russell was going home, but in actuality there was no chance that he was going home, and Zane was always going to be the one. But they sure made him look horrible.
Yeah, it seems like it seemed like to a certain degree he might have just wanted to go, or so I don't know. He never gave a confessional to such an extent, and maybe that's a far-fetched theory in the first place. But he really, like, if he wasn't making such an active effort to get himself voted out, he was not going. At least that's how it appeared.
Yeah, I think his logic was he wanted to try to appear humble, and instead he just put a big old red target on his head.
Yeah, and I don't think he was, like, throwing the challenge to orchestrate this play.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
I think that what he was trying to do after the challenge was take responsibility, and I felt like the only way, because I think to pretend that he wasn't responsible for the challenge loss would have looked badly upon him. So I think it actually makes sense to take responsibility. But
yeah,
is once people recognize, you know, and said thank you very much for taking responsibility, and then given the reciprocal, oh, but, you know, we're a team and it was a team loss speech, you know, I think at that point that's when you shut up and say, okay, great, it's a team loss, now let's vote off Russell.
Yeah, and then when they would come up and say, hey, we're going to vote out Russell, they'd be like, oh, I don't think we should do that. He definitely has an idol.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was – and then, you know, because, like, Zane has this information where he sees Russell find the idol – not find it directly, but he sees him messing around with it when he's picking up the wood, and he talks to him, and he gets Russell to just straight lie to him. And then he does the opposite of good with his information where he just uses it to further get himself voted out. It was really, I have to imagine, Gary, yeah.
Y'all, we can't vote for Russell. They may have made a new rule about returning players.
Yeah.
Think about it. Oh, so stupid. Slow motion car crash, son of a bitch.
I'm so
about Survivor now. You've got me totally steamed.
Oh, I'm glad I did.
Brutal.
The rest of this should be a good show. Tom.
In with a 6 IQ. Who thought he was smart? He thought he was so damn smart the whole time. this is going to be the greatest play of all time. This is my plan. Shut up, man. You see what you're doing to me here, Dom? You see what you're doing to me here, Colin?
This is, we're doing what we do. We just make people irate.
So pissed off.
Well, yeah, I'm guessing for season 26 you'll at least diversify your portfolio with your first pick.
Season 26, I am taking the returning alpha male player with my first pick.
Okay.
The one person who can absolutely not be removed, they will be my first pick, and I will survive that week, and I'll be extraordinarily happy to have done so.
Yeah, Gary, you as a gambling man yourself, perhaps, understand the value is the sweat. It's not victory, it's you want the sweat.
You know what? As a man who doesn't get the sweat for the rest of the season, go to hell.
All right, fair enough.
So going back to our original question at the beginning of the interview, my reason for coming on, vent about Zane.
Yeah, perfect. And that's something I'm certainly glad that you got to get that off your chest. I can't imagine how frustrating it is because I did not lose in the first round. Okay. So, Gary, where do you think the Matsing tribe goes from here?
I think it's Malcolm's tribe. I think that's pretty obvious. And I think it strikes me as fairly obvious that Russell's the next one to go if they have somebody go anytime soon.
Well, now that Malcolm's gotten rid of his biggest intellectual competition, Zane, that's, I guess, a pretty solid pick.
Well, yeah, at least amongst men.
Do you have Zane above Russell Swan in terms of as a tactician in Survivor?
I think the two of them are very, very evenly matched. I think, like I said, the juxtaposition of their increasingly stupid comments putting themselves in deeper and deeper water was remarkable. You know, for them to have that footage over a 39-day span, let alone a 3-day span, was pretty awesome. I think Zane was – neither one can win. And Russell Swan's going to last longer over, 100 runnings of the show on average. Neither one's going to win, ever.
It makes me curious about – you know, we hit on this point a while ago about the Russell Swan. If he does anything but get medevaced, we probably see a much different Russell Swan his first time, and I'm sure probably returning is out of the question.
Well, yeah, I think that if he doesn't get medevaced, all that happens is eventually some people turn on him, he doesn't figure it out, and he gets booted.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So if we can get it a little bit in now to this season kind of moving forward, are you optimistic about, looking forward to these episodes and seeing this game play out?
Yeah, they've got some interesting characters on them, on the show, and, so some of them on an entertainment value level, and some of them on an intellectual value, it'll be a fun group. I don't like the returning of a Boston Rob or a Coach or an Ozzie, who is a truly dominant personality who doesn't really allow us to see everybody else. I want to meet these new people. They're interesting. They're diverse and different, and I'm glad that, they have the balance with the old guys, but at the same time, I'm interested to get to know the new guys, and I think we're going to faster because of the lack of a dominant personality like Rob's. I don't know how most people feel about Rob's last season. I thought it was a terrible season because it was really reality. It was cast away as a reality show.
Yeah. It was one guy in his Red Sox hat, basically.
Right. Yeah. And I would much rather not know.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid point. And I think basically what I took away from this opening episode is I really, really like this cast in a big way. And maybe I was really high on the South Pacific cast and still am, but I could see this cast maybe even overtaking them as far as like recent casts go as the best and most entertaining. I feel like there's a lot of talent left out here in terms of like entertainment, and there may be a couple misses for sure. I'm sure not every episode is going to be fantastic, but I really am pretty optimistic about this season as we move forward. I'm hoping it continues to be as compelling as this. I thought this first episode was. So now, Gary, I guess the big question is, gun to your head today, who do you got? Who you got as the winner?
Hmm.
No winner pick yet?
I think Malcolm's an easy choice, but I'm not sure that I love his game position enough that I can make him one. I said before the season I actually really like Pete, and I know that Dom is not a fan, and he didn't get a whole lot of TV time. I don't know, the thing I find interesting about this cast is that, with the exception of Malcolm, there's very the very little that stands out to me in terms of great tactical players. Oh, maybe it's Nice pick. She's in the same position as Malcolm is. I think he's an outplayer. It's a cop out, but I don't really have one. I think we're going to see a winner this year. We're probably going to see a winner this year who wouldn't win most of the time in other casts.
Okay, why do you say that?
Because I think the average cast has about 5 or 6 winning players. I don't think that there are 5 or 6 winning players in this one.
Okay, that's it. I feel like the average cast probably has at least the average modern cast, I would say, has slightly lower than that. I think old like vintage seasons, definitely the percentage of players that had a shot to win was higher. Although I don't know. I feel like Denise, if it weren't for her position, there's a lot to love about Denise. There's a lot to love about Malcolm, I think. I'm still going to stick with my girl, Dawson. I feel like she's in a decent spot. I feel like she's doing fine with all the people. Dom, do you have any thoughts on who might win?
I think it's going to be either Scoopin or RC. Like, they seem like the two most obvious candidates right now. On one level, I think RC is a better pick, although she seems to be playing too hard, too fast, potentially. Like, I think she's a much higher variance pick than someone like Scoopin. But I'll go with RC for now.
I actually agree with the sentiment you expressed that RC is playing too hard. I think Scoopin's actually a pretty solid pick, though.
Okay. So do you, either of you guys have any more, like, general stuff to talk about this season before we wrap up on it?
Have I mentioned that I really don't like Zane?
Once or twice. Before we get out of here, actually, Gary, one thing I want to discuss is after the season, there's going to be another class of the Survivor Hall of Fame. Gordon confirmed as much, and we would definitely love to have you back on to do another Hall of Fame discussion podcast sometime down the line.
Obviously. Happy to do it.
Excellent.
It's obvious that you want me on. I mean, it's obvious that I would be happy to do it.
Well, we obviously do want you on, and very much looking forward to that. Before we get out of here, where can people find you?
Oh, before that, I have to say, though, you got to make sure I get on for that episode before Gordon gets on for his next. I got to stay ahead of these people. Right now, I think, am I the only person besides you two who's been on 3 episodes?
I think we've been on slightly more than 3, but yeah, I think you are the first to get to 3.
I said besides you two, obviously.
Yeah, no, I know.
Okay, so I'm the first one to get to 3. I don't want these usurpers to pass me.
I think Koss is about to tie.
I don't mind a tie.
Okay.
I was the first one to get there.
Well, Gordon, I think, is still at 2. Nonetheless, we're definitely very excited to have you. I'm sure you're going to be at 4 very soon for that Hall of Fame discussion podcast. So everyone definitely be on the lookout for that. And Gary, how can people get in touch with you now or find your work?
I'm still using the same email, the same Twitter account, at GaryWise1. And I also very occasionally will post about my Curacao adventures on jgarywise.com. Do some column work on ESPN.com/poker, globalpokerindex.com, and PokerPA. I'm busy these days, but it's a good kind of busy. Thanks for having me, guys. It's always a lot of fun, and I hope that I didn't come off as too punchy. I'm actually a little bit sick today, kind of on fumes. So I hope that didn't come across too much, except for with my ranting on Zane, which I think was completely justified regardless of my exhaustion.
Hey, Gary, one thing quickly before you go. I wanted to ask you at the top of the show, but didn't get a chance. What are your thoughts on Ian winning?
What I actually posted on my Twitter account is that I predicted Ian at the beginning of the season, and I think he played a good game, and I was disappointed.
Okay. You think he played a good game?
I think he played a good game. I don't think it's a perfect game, but I don't... Given the chaos that Dan was introducing in the house, I don't think he could play a perfect game and make it to the end.
Is this like a default thing where he won, therefore he must have done a few things right, or do you actively like certain aspects of his game?
I think he's generally speaking a sociable guy, and he's a sympathetic guy, and I think he played on that pretty well. I think that Brittany's love for him is evidence of that, and I think that his winning 6-1 is evidence of that, too. And it's another thing to be lovable and nerdy when you have the Franks and the Dans of the world trying to push you around. And he didn't allow that to happen. You know, he fought back. And I think that's actually a pretty strong quality. I think that's evidence of what Boogie was talking about with regards to his growing up and becoming a man in the house. When you're a skinny little Leonard from Big Bang Theory looking dude, and you have a 6'4" muscle bound son of a guy named Sid fucking Vicious yelling at you, it is hard to talk back. I think if a guy who looked like Frank was bitching me out, I would want to run. And the fact that Ian did not run, I thought, showed a lot of character. I don't think he played a tactically perfect game. Like, obviously, he was under some misconceptions about his level of involvement. You know, the I created the Quack Pack thing being what it is. But I think he kept himself, generally speaking, in the good half of the game, which in Big Brother seems like a really important part of it.
Yeah, that's it. I didn't even realize you were watching the season.
Yeah, I didn't have you pegged as a Big Brother fan.
I don't watch it religiously. I didn't see every episode this season. There were certainly times where I would miss the week and I would find out who won veto, like who got put up and who won veto, and then I just watched the elimination episode.
Yeah.
But I found Dan's game to be absolutely riveting. There's a real comparison to be made between Dan's game and Russell Hansen's game.
I said the exact same thing. I thought I agree completely, and I don't know why people aren't willing to discuss it like that.
I think Poverty losing in Heroes vs. Villains is a much more apt comparison.
I disagree.
I disagree because Poverty didn't play with the same aggression that Dan and Russell did. Like, there's an all-out blitzkrieg aggression to the way those two play the game.
No, so I'm with Jared.
It's unique
amongst
deep runs in the history of reality TV.
Okay, I can buy that, actually. What do you think about the differences between the two games, leaving aside how refined either of them is as a TV product?
I think there's flaws in both. I think, like, Survivor, the flaws now becoming very obvious in the form of repeated pagongings. Big Brother does not allow for that, which I think is good. I think that challenges play too large a role in the direction of Big Brother.
Yeah, towards the end game, they definitely do. The veto becomes just, like, massive in the end of Big Brother.
That's me wanting to be a tactical player. Like, I want the Dan Gieseling who makes the biggest tactical moves to win, whereas there are people who will argue that Ian deserved to win because he won four challenges. You know, and I agree with what Dan said. You know, who cares about a little golden ball?
Yeah.
You know, but there are some people who certainly care about a little golden ball. So,
right, yeah,
you know,
namely the jury.
In this case, it wasn't about the golden ball. I think it was about voting against Dan. I think that's really what happened. I think people were just fed up with Dan. I think they had a lot of Ponderosa-style talk, and they all just kind of agreed, no. He went too far. Swearing on the Bible was too big a deal. And for what it's worth, I'm a guy for whom swearing on the Bible is exactly the same as swearing on a box of Kleenex.
Yeah.
But I don't think that it's like that.
Yeah, no, and that's the problem is I think I think in a game sense, competition's way too much on juries' votes. Like, I, it's crazy to me every year when people are like, oh, I want however many immunities, however many HOHs and vetoes, as if that's something other than like, okay, well, that helped you win the game was happening, but now we're not talking about that. Now we're talking about who's winning this game.
Right.
But the problem is jurors look at that. People look at that and go, oh, well, he did win the competitions, and competitions are a part of the game. And I think for people like us, it's easier to separate that.
You know, for what it's worth, I misread the jury. Because I sure as hell never thought that Joe would be a more influential jurist than Brittany, for example.
Well, do you think he was?
I think he was. I think Brittany kept on talking about the brilliant tactical game that Dan played, and Joe kept on talking about the immorality of the way he played, and that argument went out.
I think Brittany talking so much positively about Dan perhaps was, you know, again, slightly creative editing, and also the producer saying, we need something good, you guys saying something about Dan that's good so we can air this so there's doubt no matter who the final two are.
That's interesting. I did not get a creative editing vibe from Brittany's.
Okay.
I just thought Brittany was an experienced player who respected what he had done.
All right. Yeah, well, Gary, thanks again. So I mean, I don't have any other Big Brother, unless Dom does.
Hey, my pleasure. It's always fun to come on.
Yeah, we'll certainly see you in the thread. We'll have you back on here, at least for the Hall of Fame.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks, boys.
Take care.
Yeah. See you.
Cheers.